want to thank you. I'm really inspired by three of you. Great, great job. Thank you very much. Really, great pleasure to be with you all these days. I have two little questions. One is, would you please make me an order in Buddhism, Tao, Dharma, mindfulness?
Vipassana.
Vipassana. Okay, I'm a little confused with all these words. Maybe stupid questions, but this will help me. And another question is, where's the God?
Little questions.
These are the small questions.
Okay. Shall we start with the first question?
For me, first of all, Tao and Taoism, I'm not so, don't know so much about it besides the little reading. But as I see that and many other wisdom traditions, you might say, I see it as all groups of wise knowledge, ideas, directions, inspirations, and techniques and tools to be more free. And different people are attracted to different traditions, different ways of working with the mind and the heart and the body. Regarding mindfulness, vipassana, what was there?
Buddhism,
yeah. So I don't know if it's so interesting to get into this really dry and technical piece of information, but well, there are many books about it, but generally there is Buddhism is like the religion or the tradition that all these practices come from, practice of vipassana, mindfulness. You might say that mindfulness is more the practice or the qualities we develop, and vipassana is actually more the result of the practice. Because vipassana is actually seeing clearly, seeing directly things. So when you practice a lot of mindfulness and the other Buddhist practices, what appears gradually is more and more clear and deep seeing into the nature of reality, into the nature of things, which is liberating those ways of seeing. But sometimes vipassana is actually used to name the practice itself. So that's why there is some confusion and maybe more. The word mindfulness in our times actually got more another kind of meaning of non-religious, secular ways to practice and to work with the mind, which is not necessarily connected with any tradition, with any religion. And actually today the word mindfulness became something that many people use for all kinds of things which are sometimes could be considered even weird or not so connected to what is supposed to be meant. But I'm not talking about that, because this is really, no, people use words, take words and do whatever they want with them. But I'm talking about the real practice. So there is a way to present and practice mindfulness in the world which is not connected to Buddhist Dharma and religion. And that opens the door to, from what I see, because I also do that, it opens the door to many, many people who would never come to anything like that. They would be really scared. And the language of non-Buddhist mindfulness is more inviting, and many kinds of people are coming to start a practice, and it's beautiful. I hope, I mean, this is just a tip in the ocean. I don't know even where to go from here. But there is a lot you can read. And about God.
Go right ahead.
I don't know what to say about God. It's a word. an idea. I think this word means, like mindfulness, this word means different things to different people. And for me, I think the point is how lightly or tightly we hold this word or this idea or this belief in our mind. Because the teaching of the Buddha is not so much about the ideas, but about how we grasp and hold them. So that's where the problem starts, how serious we take this idea of God. The Buddha, as much as I know, didn't talk about himself as a god or anything divine. So if you want to be really like Tantiti or
concise.
So there is no god in Buddhism. But that's kind of it. I feel it's something, it's a bit too direct to say because there are qualities which you can say are divine, like the divine qualities of the heart and all kinds of beautiful aspects of the mind. So some people say this is God, this is divine. So it depends how you relate to this world. But the existence of an entity that is beyond everything we know, that is creating, that is controlling somehow, this is a belief that I think the Buddha would not support. I try to be very
thank you. With regard to the first question, the Buddha of course lived in northern India and taught there for more than 40 years. And then of course the teaching spread to other parts of Asia. So north to Tibet, down to Sri Lanka, and then to Thailand, and Japan, China. And with each taking up of Buddhism, with each culture, there was a new kind of flavor in the traditions and the rituals and the way that the Dharma was practiced. And so you can see this today with the differences in the Mahayana tradition and the Theravada tradition, for example. And then of course in Thailand there was also the Thai forest tradition, which is the lineage which I am from, where the monks lived and practiced in the forest. And Ajahn Buddhadasa, for example, had a very broad understanding. He spoke about some of the Mahayana teachings as well. So the Dharma is, I would say the Dharma is the practice of the Buddha's teachings. Mm-hmm. Buddhism is the religious aspect. And of course in Thailand you will see many rites and rituals and religion practiced, often without very much relationship to the actual teachings of the Dharma. In fact, because I teach in the Thai monastery in India, in Bodh Gaya, a Thai monk, really saw what I was doing there one year, and he decided that he wanted to come the next year. He was from a monastery in Thailand where his job was mostly working with tourists. And so he actually disrobed in order to come to the retreat in India. He learned English and disrobed to come to the retreat. So sometimes the Dharma is lost in the rites and rituals of religion. Sometimes, of course, in the religious practice is a wonderful devotion of the heart, which is also lost when Buddhism is taken in a rather secular way. So we have to be intelligent. We also have to look and see what kind of practice suits us. What is it that wakes us up? And as far as I'm concerned, do whatever brings extraordinary freedom and liberation to your life. Vipassana as was already said, means seeing into, insight into. And this is what we're doing here. We're doing actual practice with the hope or the intention of seeing into the nature of reality. As for the question about God, when the Buddha was asked by a Brahmin, how can I dwell with God? How can I live with God? He said, we live with God or godliness when we practice what he called the Brahma Viharas. Some of you will be very familiar with them, the divine abodes of the heart. And these are love, compassion, joy, and equanimity. And these can be seen and known as rather divine qualities. The Buddha viewed the question, is there a God or not, as a speculative question. And he was actually not interested in speculative questions. He thought that his teaching should be solely about the fact that there is dukkha, there is suffering and dissatisfaction in this world, and liberation from it. So there's a whole list of questions which he thought were speculative and which he didn't really spend a lot of time answering. Sometimes he refused to answer them at all. From my personal perspective, I certainly don't believe that there's a, someone sitting up there in the sky, a personified kind of God who's controlling everything, because if so, there's a great mess down here. And I wouldn't think he was very good at his job. So I don't have that kind of view, but I do have a great appreciation for our capacity as human beings to directly know the sacred. And I have no problem whatsoever if someone uses the word God. I have no problem at all with the use of the word God. The difficulty is sometimes understanding exactly what that person would mean. And for me, if I were to say, is there an equivalent in the Dharma, I would probably say it's the perhaps the recognition of that which is unconditioned, not bound anywhere. To me, this would be something rather divine, or a knowing of the sacred, a profound, transcendent knowing. So that's how I would see God or godliness. And I think that often when the Dharma is taught, it can be taught in a very dry way. And I don't take that dry position, as you can see. And I also think that there's needs to be great freedom in the way that we understand it. And as I've been teaching the Dharma for quite a number of years now, what I have seen and known is that there are many ways to understand and many spiritual experiences, and people's descriptions and paths are quite different and all very valid. So there isn't only one way to see and understand, there's many.
I'm glad they left me the my favorite missing piece.
Yeah.
So the spirit of the Tao is of Chinese origin and is in many ways closely related to Dharma and in some ways quite different. And it's it's based on awareness and attention and openness to natural laws and natural flow of the universe and how to live more in accord, in harmony with those laws which are greater than ourselves, which are connected to the movement of nature and learning from nature. It is rather wild and uneducated and unformed and spontaneous and open and free from dogma, and in many ways it's close to the spirit of Buddhism, but it's less structured. There are less notions and practices. It's sometimes more dynamic, sometimes very still, sometimes movement oriented, and especially open to, I think it's close to, in many ways, to the concept of upaya in the Dharma, which is a very flexible, non-dogmatic, open attention to see what is appropriate in this moment, in these circumstances, without any fixed views about how things should be. So in that sense, it's very close. The origin is Chinese. Historically said 5,000 years ago by Lao Tzu, who started the tradition, and it is said that Zen is the merge, is the baby of, Father Buddhism and Mother Tao, so something like that. So it has a little bit of that spontaneous spark open, and also has the wisdom, knowledge, tradition from the Dharma side.
And God.
No God there. Welcome to come to ask another question now.
Yes, come.
Again, thank you very much. Experience should take a long time to understand exactly. And I've changed my views quite a few times during this week in different ways. My question is, you speak a lot of the heart, and it's not the physical heart you're speaking of. Is in the Dharma, is there a place or is there any importance to a physical heart, or even specifically and generally to the physical body? Does the Dharma talk about using the physical body to get to stillness, to get to quiet, and all the rest of what you're trying to get to? Thank you.
So mindfulness of the body is the foundation of the practice. The practice is not about thinking and imagining and mental action, which is disembodied or disconnected from the body. So Ajahn Buddhadasa, which is Christopher and Radha's teacher, which he just mentioned, once said, as a guideline to practice, do not do anything that takes you away from the body. And my feeling is sometimes in the guidance that Radha gave with the Anapanasati Sutta, many times people hear the letting go and the cessation and the freedom and the joy part, but they miss the I shall breathe in and I shall breathe out, which is something that happens in a bodily way. And so we don't just think about cessation or freedom or letting go. The contemplation in Dharma is always embodied. You don't leave the body and just think about things. First foundation of mindfulness is body, and dwelling in the body is what is called embodiment. There's a lot of emphasis on sensing the body from inside, the bodily life. I don't think specifically the heart organ, but more the liveness that happens in the body. And the body can serve as a teacher, can serve as forgot the word.
What's the dish that you would?
The field.
Field of practice, it's another word that I'm missing there. It is, the body can be an ally, it can be a teacher, it can teach you about impermanence, it can teach you about death, it can teach you about joy, it can teach you about liveliness, chiyuniyut, chayut, and it can teach you about non-control and about respect and humility, and that you don't control this body, but you still take care of it best you can, as this is your vehicle and your home for this life. So there's a kind of balanced approach. And also, so first we base ourselves in body awareness, or in some kind of shamatha or samadhi, in depth of stability, of presence in the body, of embodiment, of body that is filled with mind. And then, as the Buddha suggested, you make some kind of steady foundation, and then you bring on a theme. You take on a theme of impermanence and look into it in a bodily way. So we contemplate it with the inhale and exhale. We don't just think about stuff.
The body for me is also, besides everything that Thomas said, is something that is seen during the years of practice differently than in the beginning. And I think part of what we said, vipassana, involves some kind of, you say, collapse or letting go or falling of the concept of the body, and of the body as a fixed thing, and it's being experienced more as an experience and less in a conceptual way. And it's hard to describe it, but something fundamentally starts to change regarding the question, what is this thing you call it body? And I think part of it was in the talk, I think I touched it a little bit about going down, you can say down, from the level of the idea, the concept of the body, to experience this as a flow of sensations. And also maybe you can experience it as something you see, as something you sometimes smell. Sometimes you hear the body in your hearing door, breath, the sound of breath. And I think directing the practice towards this direction can open something very new and transformative.
I'd like to add that our relationship to the body is rather important. And the teachings point out that although, of course, there is a body, this body is not me, not mine, and not who I am. And so this is the key point in relationship to the body, I think, in the teachings. And yes, as Thomas said, we feel and experience our practice with the body as a basis. Whenever we have a difficult mind state, for example, we come directly to the sensation in the body and work with that. Sometimes we think we're in the body, sometimes we think we're out of the body, and there's all kinds of different perspectives on this. But essentially, it's to look and see that there is this form that is not me, not mine, and not who I am. And if you've ever sat with someone who has just died, you will see very clearly that we are not the body. And this is, of course, one of the great teachings and practices in the Dharma. And like everything else, our relationship to the body needs to be one of care, compassion, and kindness. This rather too much pushing and striving with the body, or expecting the body to be a particular way when it perhaps isn't. Yeah, or completely ignoring the body and just having the assumption that my body will do what I want, until suddenly we find ourselves with an uninvited illness, and then it's a matter of going, oh, what is this? Really seeing into the nature of things. Another question, please.
I will ask in Hebrew. Okay.
Yeah, I'll translate. I'll translate aloud, so it's okay. Put a microphone.
על אברהם והרה, ששלושת שלושת היכולות הראשונות, מאוד ברור איך הן מתרחבות במהלך התרגול, ואיך הן מתרחבות בהתאמה ב... אתה לא צריך.
אני לא צריך. אני לא צריך. אני לא צריך.
איך הן מתרחבות במהלך התרגול, ואיך הן מתרחבות בהתאמה ביום יום. וזה נשאר מאוד מאוד דומה, כאילו נהיה יותר ג'וי ויותר אהבה, ו... אבל קומיוניטי, בחוויה שלי, האיכות שלה בזמן תרגול, בייחוד בזמן ריטריטים ארוכים, היא לא דומה בשום צורה להתגשמות שלה ביום יום. ואני שואלת את זה בעצם, אם זה משהו שקורה... כאילו יש בה משהו, אפילו אני לא מוצאת את המילים לתאר את זה, איכותית, שונה מכל מצב תודעה יומיומי שאני מכירה.
את יכולה להגיד טיפה יותר, איך את חווה את ההבדל? מה החוויה לכרית, מה החוויה ביומיומית?
אני חושבת שביומיום הקומנטי אני חווה את זה יותר את המהות של זה, באמת. את יכולת לבוא במגע. עם קשת יותר רחבה של מצבים של אנשים, של סיטואציות, עם איזשהו... כאילו אני קצת חווה את התוצאה של זה, אבל לא את המצב שאותו אין לי לתאר,
נראה לי שמה שחסר זה תיאור יותר, אם את יכולה, של החוויה על הכרית, מה זה שם, מה זה
עשו.
ויש איזה שם.
אני חושבת שעל הכרית זה מרגיש ממש...
על הכרית בבית או על הכרית בריטריט?
לא, בריטריט. ובריטריט הם ארוכים בפרט. זה גם כזה שאלה בסוגריים. אפשר, כמה אפשר
להתקדם? שחר, בריטריטים ארוכים, איך זה מרגיש שהקונים? כי זה מרגיש...
אפשר לחזור על השאלה?
אנחנו נסכם.
אנחנו עובדים על
השאלה. עובדים על השאלה.
יש שאלים שלא יודעים מה זה ברמה
גזרה. נגיד, כן.
אני מדבר על זה עוד רגע. איך שאת חווה את הקונים מתים בריטריט הארוך? מה יש שם? מה זה בשבילך?
אולי מה אין שם?
אין שם הכל. הכל בסדר.
הכל בסדר. חוויה של הכל בסדר.
אבל זה הכל בסדר שהוא גם בחיים יותר ויותר עם התרגול יש את החוויה של הכל בסדר. יש שם משהו איכותי אחר.
Okay, we'll try to
wrap it up.
Relate. We'll try to say something about the community.
So you can try first. So that I can understand the
and
question.
And Brahma Vihara is also a little bit, what is it?
Okay. Brahma Vihara, the translation is divine abiding, and these are or the four immeasurable mind states, those that are boundless, infinite, infinitely developable, and have no limits in their extent. So in the Buddhist teachings, we can develop the quality of love and compassion boundlessly. That means to all people, to all beings, to all in the past, future, animate and inanimate, all kinds. There's something that is that can always grow and expand, so that, and can always be developed. So the four, as Radha mentioned, are love, compassion, joy. Those are the first three. And the fourth, which the question said, she said, it's qualitatively different, is equanimity, or upekkha in Pali. And in upekkha, it's equanimity, shivyon, kohen is referring to ishtavut and nefesh, or yetzivut pnimit, or shalva, lo bidiyuk, shalva is serenity, is not exactly, equanimity is the stability, inner steadiness that is not tossed by pleasant and unpleasant so easily. So it is actually practice in every moment in the practice that comes, we're just open to being with anything that arises. So
like stillness?
No, it's not the stillness, it's the non-reactive quality, the steady quality which is not tossed by unpleasant or the pleasant. So if a desire arises, you have a fantasy and there's something that follows it. So the equanimity is part of it, is the clarity of seeing this as something that is either pleasant or unpleasant, and not abandoning the quality of presence or clarity in the pursuit of the two basic forms of clinging, which are, one is aversion, is fighting against, is pushing away, and the other is grasping or searching or clinging or longing. So that's, in my sense, it's quality that is developed quite slowly and has to do with maturity. Maturity in life and maturity in the practice. We can experience it in many short moments in the practice, that there's maybe a strong experience coming physically or emotionally, but there is some steadiness and a sense of capacity of, I can be with this. I can be steady and open to this and not grasp and not fight and not dissociate. So that's kind of, but there's something that is really building up slowly with the years. And I feel this is, maybe for me, this is the greatest change that I can track along the years, is the depth of equanimity or inner stability that is not so white in emotion, in storms of emotions and losing myself. And then the more kind of inner sense of steadiness. So.
It's hard to relate to somebody else's experience, of course. I think naturally retreat and daily life are different. It's a different situation, different conditions, so the states of mind are different. I would think of trying to observe and to look at this experience in a retreat and see, is this solely only equanimity, or is there, are there other qualities that rise together with it, because it sounds to me something which is much deeper and wrapped with other things which are not only the equanimity. Sounds to me like there is something very peaceful and also for me, I mean, the equanimity has something very simple in it. It's really this simple ability of the mind to be with life and not be shaken, and come back easily to the balance if it's a bit shaken, and just say welcome to anything that comes. So intuitively I feel that what you describe in the retreat is combined with other beautiful and qualities that come together with it.
So equanimity is the sense of the immovable or the unwavering. So it's to be like the mountain, if you like, to be rather steady in the face of all that life presents. When I think of equanimity, I think of my dear friend and Dharma teacher, Sexton, who died some years ago from cancer. A couple of days before he died, I visited him. I was with my friend Will, another Dharma teacher from Australia, who was one of Sexton's best friends. And so we went to his house, and there he was in his bedroom, a meditator to the end. He was sitting up in bed, and he had liver cancer. He had been incredibly steady throughout the 2 or 3 years before in terms of dealing with all of the treatment and surgeries and other kinds of treatments that he had in order to live. But he'd reached the point, of course, where he realized that he was dying. So there he was, sitting up in bed. He had liver cancer, completely yellow. And he was just filled with love. So the equanimity and the love are really related, because when we're really steady in the face of things, what we do experience and express, it can be the love, can be the joy, can be the compassion. So there he was in bed. I'll finish the story because I think it's sweet. And he just grabbed me in this big hug and started kissing me passionately on the lips. And I was a bit taken aback because his wife was in the room next door. And I thought, oh. And then he grabbed my friend Will, his friend, and kissed him just as passionately on the lips. And just, he was just flowing with love. It was unstoppable. He just could not stop expressing the love. And then as we said our last goodbyes, he looked at me and he said, "Radha, don't be sad. It really is okay. This is equanimity in the face of death." He said, "It really is okay." So when I think of equanimity, I always think of him, because he was the embodiment of that divinity. He was so steady and uncomplaining in everything that he faced. And the equanimity, if you like, set the love free. So the equanimity is related to the other Brahma Viharas. And that's why there's this sense of being rather more broad, because if you like, it's in and through all of the others as well. That's my particular view of it. Ah, come.
Now, after these two questions of beginners, the first one, you talked about it throughout the retreat, but I still would like to clarify a little bit, please. If the self should not cling to the desire to peace and to joy, and to enlightenment, and to anything, what is the drive for practicing? That's the first one. And the second one is more informative, maybe. Are there women monasteries in Asia? And if not, is it because anything deep, essential, or because of historical reasons?
So the first question was about clinging, not clinging to self. desire becomes problematic when it's blind wanting. If we have the intention to meditate, the intention to practice, that's quite different from problematic desire. However, as our practice goes along, some of us will find that we get rather attached to our meditation experiences, and there is the desire to wake up. We have the desire that comes sometimes quite strong, that says, I want to be awake. And of course, the shadow of that view is, I'm not awake now. And so we get ourselves rather caught in this. The desire for liberation is like all desires when we cling to it, problematic. And it's said, and I think it is, I think this is true, it's the last desire to go. So we practice, we have the intention to wake up. Therefore, we are motivated to practice, and we are motivated to practice because we understand something as we go. It's not that we say, oh, practice, and nothing happens for you. What happens as you practice is that the insights start to come. If you pay attention, I promise you, insights will come. We need to hear the Dharma, we need to reflect on it, and practice with that recipe. We will wake up. We get in a tangle when the wanting mind clings on to being the meditator who wants to be different from how we are already, and we put enlightenment way ahead of us, and we run after it as if we couldn't access it right here and now. So, yes, from me, great encouragement to practice, practice, practice. So really be diligent, really be disciplined. Don't hold back. Throw yourself in, and then you will see and understand for yourself. Even the desire for liberation ceases.
And just in this regard, I wanted to offer a metaphor I like about it. It's like you have a fire. You use a piece of wood to arrange the fire, and to put everything inside, and then eventually you throw this one also to the fire.
Mm-hmm.
So this is a little bit like the desire for liberation.
Wow. Yeah, great.
Fantastic. I love that.
Just the Dharma emphasizes much more intention and motivation rather than clinging to specific results. So it's actually natural, really okay to want to feel better, to want to feel love and loved, to want to fulfill yourself, it's okay to want to experience less pain. It's natural, it's almost unavoidable. It's kind of built in the Veda, the sensation. It's unpleasant and we don't want it, that's okay. The clinging is, I have to have it my way. The results, there is a demanding quality that I have to have, that it should be this way. And there's a controlling quality, there's a contracted quality. So it's fine it's wonderful actually to have clarity about our inner life and what we want and what we aspire to. And what is our motivation? And but that, with the wisdom of knowing that we can't always get what we want,
mm-hmm.
and can you be okay with? And the intention is something that is endless in the sense of a deep, deep commitment to growth. A deep commitment to love, to non-hatred, or to non-violence. A deep commitment to truth, to looking deeply, to honesty, and to openness. So this is the level of intention. And when we water this, then we are less busy with getting the specific results, because I can't rely on health or money or getting whatever it is in the world that I want to, and it's natural to want.
Oh, the female monastery.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. The structure of the Dharma, of Buddhism, in Asia, that I'm familiar with, is incredibly patriarchal. I am doing my bit to address this. And the little bit that I am doing is that the abbot of the Thai monastery in Bodh Gaya invites me to teach them. The Thai monastery in Bodh Gaya is the most important Thai monastery in India. It's actually the royal Thai monastery. It's a copy of the temple of the king's palace in Bangkok. And it's a very important and special place. So it is a great privilege and an honor to be invited. Never having been a nun, in the past even, not being ordained now, it's rather revolutionary to be in this position. And I came to teach there, of course, through teaching there with Christopher, who taught there for 39 years. And some of those years we taught together, then the buildings were knocked down and rebuilt again, and then now it's me alone who is leading that retreat. At first I think they wondered who this person was who turned up from Australia and started to teach in the monastery, but now there's a beautiful relationship established, and there's been some wonderful kind of breakthroughs. The abbot is incredibly supportive of the retreat there and of the teaching. In fact, the first year we re-established it, he wrote saying that the retreat would be offered as a dana to us, that the Thai monastery fed us and provided accommodation. And he offered that as his dana to us if we would please come and I would teach the retreat. So of course, what could I say? Yes, I'm there. It is important that women have a voice in the Dharma. I absolutely, absolutely appreciate the voices of men, and the teachers that I have had in my life, except for Vimala Thakur, a wonderful Indian woman, have all been men. So I have great appreciation for those voices of freedom. It doesn't matter which gender they are. But I also see that in the Thai tradition, certainly, there are no fully ordained nuns. There, or at least there weren't until very recently. And a monk in Australia, Ajahn Brahm, fully ordained some women. In the tradition, all of the fully ordained women had died without ordaining anybody else. And so it was seen that that lineage of the bhikkhunis, the women, the ordained women, had died out. This was the Thai view. However, Ajahn Brahm was actually excommunicated for his action, yet still the nuns are fully ordained, and some other nuns were ordained in Sri Lanka. And now there's a group of nuns north of Bangkok who live together in a community and are fully ordained, and the tradition will continue. I think that many people have said that there's much appreciation for the voice of a woman in the Dharma, and not that it's necessarily different from the voice of a man, but I think sometimes the expression is in a way that can be understood. As a young woman, I was very interested in Buddhism, but when I went to the monasteries, I saw that women were rather subservient there. And so I couldn't really take up that position. I didn't want to be the person who bowed to even the the most newly ordained monk, because the women need to bow to even the youngest monk. So it is still rather sexist, and in the monasteries, in some monasteries it's there's great equality. In other monasteries, the women are expected to do the cooking and the cleaning and all of the menial tasks, and have little time to actually come to the retreat. So all of these things are slowly, slowly changing. And I think, of course, that there will be great change with regard to this. I hope there'll be great change with regard to women and the Dharma, because the text, in the Pali Canon, there's certainly some wonderful suttas by women.
Maybe just worth mentioning another well-known teacher called Tenzin Palmon. She's from the Tibetan tradition, if anybody's interested in that. She's leading this revolution, you can say, in the Tibetan tradition also.
Yes, she built a monastery for women in Nepal, or where is it? In India. India. And open something very new.
Okay. And one more question. Yes, come.
I'm really embarrassed, but I'm trying to let go of the eye that is clinging to the views of other people about me.
You might have positive.
It's a question about sharing experiences, especially difficult experiences with other people.
Yes.
For example, at work, when someone is hurt me and I'm disappointed and I'm angry, and then don't want to share this experience because of course sharing can bring great relief and bring insights from other people, but I feel that it's also make me like dwelling in the past and not in the present moment, and analyzing it, and even make the anger greater and intensifying it. So the question is how to decide to share or not to share, and how to share that it will not intensify the anger.
Talking about sharing it with a person who
yeah.
made you angry, or general with friends?
No, with friends. And
okay.
Well, I think it's always the question of what will make me suffer less. What will lead to the ease of the suffering? And sometimes sharing pain of all kinds can be helpful, because we get support, when people listen to us, we don't feel alone with it, etc. I think that's good. That helps. But I think we should be careful, because, and this is something you kind of hinted, sometimes it can lead to kind of dwelling in the negative emotion, and in a way training ourselves to be more and more like this. You know what I mean? It's and there is also a lot of benefit in just containing it, being with it, letting myself feel it completely, and feel the pain, and seeing the truth in it, the reality in it, the impermanence of it, the selflessness of it, and that can bring, I think, a deeper value. So, but it's not instead of the other things, both. So, and I think gradually I learned the fine line between sharing to get support and kind of indulging in suffering. Sometimes it's even almost an addiction to my suffering and to replay it and having being heard and being seen and validate my pain and my suffering and my anger and my, and that starts to be suffering enhancing process and not relieving the suffering.
Sometimes it depends entirely on to whom you're speaking when you talk about it. If you talk to someone who's going to support your view about the other person, and you only talk to those who won't challenge you, then you could be in difficulty, because as Mully said, it could increase the sense of righteousness or righteous anger about the situation at work. However, having worked as a therapist, having worked as a psychologist for countless number of years now, I do see great benefit in talking, but not just in talking to gossip, but in talking to really see into something. And sometimes, of course, the stating of a situation that's very painful with another person, a therapist, who can be very steady, empathic, and loving, and also at the same time point to loosening up the difficulty, then that's a beneficial thing. So we have to know ourselves well, know what works for us, but certainly putting the lid on unexpressed feelings also has negative health effects and mental health effects. So we have to know, we have to do what's wise. So within us, often, we know when we overstep the line, we know when we're gossiping about somebody, we know when we're just looking for support of our viewpoint against somebody else. So, it's, again, the intention is to be free from suffering. And so if we're talking to people who can help us be free, fabulous.
I think the Dharma and the way we study and practice it here has a great value in having depth and clarity of looking into our inner life and whatever is happening in our body and mind and emotional life. And it has a rather solistic and non-expressive nature, what we do here. So some people that have difficulty with expression can find refuge on the cushion and actually block their expression or be in their comfort zone. Actually, Thich Nhat Hanh said that the cushion is sometimes the best place to hide from other people. So we should see how we use the Dharma there's a great value in expression, and there's a great value in looking and thinking to what is wise expression, what is helpful expression, and to whom you're expressing. So a very basic and important thing is the sense of safety. So in the relationship with the other person, if people are very reactive and cannot really listen, then sometimes when you share your inner life, your inner experience, you feel wasted, unheard, and you wish you didn't speak. Sometimes you share your inner life and you get into the drama and the other person feeds the drama and there's a mutual blaming and going into feeling like a victim or whatever. And then the wisdom factor sees there's something unhelpful here. There's something that is extra. But never underestimate the value of human connection and relationship. We have here the solo practice, the personal kind of journey. So we have a deep need for this deep relationship with ourselves, but we also have a deep need for connection and relationship with others. And expressing our inner experience creates relationship and creates intimacy. So it can be super important and valuable. And we can look into our own conditioning to see when we're overdoing it, and that's our tendency just to be all over the place. And when we are being of the gender of myself, which sometimes we do not express so much from our emotional life, and then there's a sense of distance. And so also returning to the equanimity, not to mix with emotional disconnect. So, and many times we can, because our emotional life becomes much more clear while we express it to an empathic, attentive, listening other. So all this is part of our life and finding our own journey together and alone.
Thank you. So let's bring this to a close now. I know there are many more questions. Perhaps we'll be able to answer a few tomorrow morning as well. So it's 20 minutes to 9. If the bell ringer could please ring the bell in about 15 minutes, and we'll come back at 9 o'clock for a short metta. But before we leave the hall now, could we just sit together for a minute or two? Just sitting with gratitude and appreciation for the teachings and for all those who have supported them throughout the years so that we may know them. Thank you for listening. It's now a walking meditation for 15 minutes, and then we'll come back for a 15-minute meditation.